So it gives me great pleasure to introduce a friend and a colleague, Mara Mustafine, brought to you courtesy of M at the Bund, of course, and the Australian, and the Australian government through the Australian Council for the Arts, its arts funding and advisory body, and the Copyright Agency Limited. Sounds like a nice bunch of people to know. Okay. Mara, she's a fourth generation Harbinka. I just learned that word, Harbinka, which makes her a true old China hand in every sense of the word. Most old China hands here, if they're two generations back, they boast about it. She's the real thing, four generations back. She's that exotic mixture of Jewish, Russian, and Tartar roots, a little bit of the best of everything. She was born in Harbin. She went to Australia in 1959. She has her MA from the Australian National University in International Relations. I consider her a real Renaissance woman, or in America we'd call her Wonder Woman. She's a business executive, a diplomat, an intelligence analyst, a journalist, an author, and now, as if that were not enough, she's working on her PhD in history. I mean, what's left? Tomorrow the world. She spent over a decade in Asia. I'd just like to mention briefly her books, which is, after all, what brings her here. Her book, Secrets and Spies, whose cover you see there and whose story she will reveal to you. It's a wonderful read. It'll break your heart, but no, not too many happy endings, except Mara is the happy ending. But anyway, Secrets and Spies, which has now been translated into Chinese, and the title Secrets and Spies was probably a little too racy, a little too dubious for the Chinese, so it's called The Harbin Files in Chinese. She did this incredible thing against these incredible odds. She got into these archives in Russia in this little window of opportunity, which she's going to tell you about. And the unknown and very sad story of her family, she sort of unpeeled it like an onion, layer after layer after layer. And she wound up, well, my favorite in this story is the lady on the cover, Man Yu, her relative. And if that were not enough, from the I would say from the ridiculous to the sublime, but it's the other way around, from the sublime to the ridiculous, she owns a dog named Genghis Khanis. And as a dog lover, this to me is the final ceiling of the friendship. Anybody who has a dog named Genghis Khanis has got to be all right with me. Anyway, with you can see pictures of not only Genghis Khanis, but also of Mara and of many of the interesting things on her website. And with no further ado, Mara Mustafine.
Thank you very much, Tess, and thank you to Michelle M. on the Bund. It is a great, great pleasure to be here. I have to say that M. on the Bund has featured in various ways, not in my book, but in the early stages. It was from a dinner on the roof in 2000 that I went the following morning with my parents to Harbin for the very first time. And it's a great honour to be speaking here in front of such a stunning audience in this very glamorous glamour bar, because I've long been fascinated by Shanghai, and glamour with a capital G was part of that. While many Harbin people and many Russians from China hold Harbin very dear, and that's the city where I was born, the stories that I heard about Shanghai always made me wish that I'd come from here. Why didn't we come from Shanghai, I asked my mother, as if there was something she could do about it. But Shanghai was always the international city, and to me, Harbin seemed Russian and provincial. But many, many Russians who came to Shanghai from Harbin in the 1930s still hold Harbin very dear, and I have to say so do I. My family was undeterred by the Japanese occupation. They stayed in Harbin right until 1959. They lived through extraordinary times. They lived through the after effects of the Russian Revolution and the Civil War. They lived through 13 years of the Japanese occupation. They lived through the Soviet liberation. They lived through the early years of the Chinese Communist Revolution. Until we went. We just missed out on the Sino-Soviet split. So I'm going to return to Harbin because I'm talking today about the Russians of China, and you can't tell that story without starting in Harbin. And I'm sure that as you looked at these photos, and those of you who have been to Harbin know that it's a distinct, there's in amongst the facades of modern Harbin, you still see inklings of old Russian architecture. That's because for the first 50 years of the last century, Harbin was a distinctly Russian town. Russian was the language of the streets, of the theatres. It was spoken in the administration. You saw photographs. There were street signs written in Harbin. Its architecture was reminiscent of Moscow and St. Petersburg. Only in nearby Fudaijian, where the 300,000 Chinese lived in the 30s, was there a sense of being in a Chinese town, and very few Russians ventured there. They lived pretty much in a Russian world in Harbin. Now, how did all of this come about? Many people know that Harbin provided a refuge for Russians fleeing the Civil War, as did Shanghai. But Harbin's Russian story actually started a long time before that with the Chinese Eastern Railway. Is that better? It's in my mouth. Thank you. So I was talking about the Chinese Eastern Railway. The Chinese Eastern Railway was the result of a deal between Qing China and Tsarist Russia, and Russia gained a concession to build a railway linking the Trans-Siberian right through the top of China to Vladivostok. That Harbin was the headquarters of the Chinese Eastern Railway Company, which was like the British East India Company. It was a commercial enterprise, but it was also effectively the civil service of what became Harbin. Harbin was the headquarters, and surrounding Manchuria was effectively a Russian colony because the Russians had extraterritorial rights right along that railway. So when I'm talking, and I might be talking about Harbin, there was also lots of little towns scattered from one end of the Russian border to the other end of the Russian border. The other day I was talking to somebody about Tsitsiha and Manchuli and Manchuria, and some of my family lived in Hailar, which was closer to the Russian border. But all of these were sort of stations on the Chinese Eastern Railway, which were effectively Russian towns. From the early days of the 20th century, people flooded to Manchuria in order to build a new life and take part in... It was a frontier town. And interestingly, many minorities, Jews, Tatars, Poles, minorities from the Tsarist Empire came to Manchuria. Why did they do that? Because the restrictions that applied in the empire proper, for instance, the ones confining Jews to live in the Pale of Settlement and restricted their numbers in various professions and schools, did not apply in Manchuria. In fact, the authorities in St. Petersburg wanted to attract minorities to be entrepreneurs in Manchuria. And I'll give you the case of Jews. Jews came very early in the from about 1898, and they played a key role in developing the natural resources and commerce of Manchuria. They built their own community institutions. You would have seen pictures of the synagogue. There were two synagogues by the 30s. And they also took an active part in the life of Russian Harbin. Even in 1909, there were 12 of the 40 members of the municipal council were Jews. Now, what a difference that was to the life that they lived in the empire proper. So the families of both my maternal grandparents came to Harbin as early settlers in the 1900s. My grandfather came to join his older brother in a meat business, and then the two of them built together a very successful partnership trading in meat and livestock. It was called Zaretsky Brothers & Co. My grandmother's family had a small dairy farm in Hailar near the border, and that's now part of Inner Mongolia. Huge numbers of people came fleeing the Bolshevik Revolution and the Civil War, and particularly after the collapse of the White Armies in Siberia, they crossed over with the White Armies into Harbin and other places. And by the mid-20s, which was the heyday, there were 120,000 Russians living in Harbin and 30,000 living in those other areas along the railway. And Harbin was a very easy place for refugees to go because they came into a city where Russian was a familiar language, architecture was familiar. The refugees also, amongst the refugees, were a large number of artists and intellectuals. So it was a very rich cultural life in this Russian world. And there was very little real engagement with the China around them. But Shanghai was different. Those refugees who came to Shanghai either directly by boat here, they came to an international city, so they couldn't quite be so cocooned. And I think there were about 6,000 of them here in the early days. Now, what changed all that was the Japanese occupation. The Japanese occupied Manchuria in 1932. That was the point where a lot of Russians started to leave Harbin and Manchuria. With the Japanese occupation came a huge decline in the economy. The Japanese wanted to take over the Chinese Eastern Railway. They wanted the Soviets out. They started a campaign of harassment, so anyone who had Soviet papers could find themselves arrested, interrogated for no particular reason. Businesses were taken over. My grandfather managed to keep his business until much later on in the 40s, but there was also a rise in anti-Semitism because the Japanese collaborated with the so-called Russian Fascist Party. The Russian Fascist Party was strongly anti-Bolshevik, but the anti-Bolshevism, which is why they appealed to the Japanese, but that was laced with a very, very strong anti-Semitism. They blamed the Jews for the revolution. There were fights, there were bad things happening, and in particular, a campaign which was, in a sense, orchestrated by the Kempeitai, the Japanese military police, to kidnap the either wealthy businessmen or their children or their families to hold them for ransom. And there was a very... it culminated in the case of the kidnapping of Simon Kaspe. Those of you who have been to Harbin may have seen the Hotel Modern. Simon Kaspe's father owned that hotel. It was the pink one, in the photos. Still there today as the Hotel Modern. The son came back from Paris to give piano concerts. He was kidnapped. There were all sorts of atrocities performed upon him, and basically he was killed. But this brought thousands of people out into the streets of Harbin, Jews, non-Jews, people were totally outraged at what was going on. And you can understand that under these circumstances, many people started to leave the Russian world. By 1935, the Japanese had bought the Chinese Eastern Railway from the Soviets. That meant that 25,000 families departed for the Soviet Union, and other people who didn't work for the railway administration also went to the Soviet Union. Many people came to Shanghai. Many people went to Tianjin also, but Shanghai got a lot of the influx of these Russians, so that by the mid-30s there were over 20,000 Russians living in Shanghai, making it the largest of the foreign communities. This also had an impact on my own family. While my direct, the parents of both my father and mother stayed on in Harbin, my grandmother's entire family went to the Soviet Union. They went to the Soviet Union, and in 1937-38 they got caught in Stalin's purges. My grandmother lost contact with her mother, her father, her sister and two brothers, and they were caught in the Great Terror. So growing up in Australia, in Cold War Australia in the 60s and 70s, I knew that there was a mysterious past there. I knew that my great-grandmother and her son were still living in Riga in Latvia. And I also saw photographs. On my grandmother's dressing table, there were photographs, and sometimes one would appear and another would appear, but one that was fairly constant was that photograph there of this young woman in a trench coat. And I asked my grandmother who she was, and she told me that this was her younger sister, and she very proudly announced that she was a dentist, you know, and maybe that was a reflection on the fact that I was studying arts. And she said, you were named in her honour. So her name was Maria, my name is Mara. They didn't want to call me Manya because her short name was Manya, but they said, Manya's too much like the shtetl, so Mara will do. So I wanted to know, where was this woman? I mean, what happened to her? She told me she died in Stalin's time, along with her father and her older brother. And Stalin's time was the euphemism that was used by many Russians for the purges. Now, I was studying Soviet politics at university, and I'm just staggered that I never drew a connection with my own family. I read Solzhenitsyn, I read Mandelstam, I knew all about what had happened, but I didn't connect it. That all changed in 1992 when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I visited Moscow. I had friends working in Moscow, and I thought, I'm going to go to Riga to visit the wife of my great uncle, because he'd passed on and my great grandmother was no longer alive, but I wanted to go and meet what little family I had left. So when I was there, she and I actually had a fight, because she was a Russian living in Latvia, and Latvia was now Latvia as opposed to a part of the Soviet Union. And she was very frightened of what was going to take place, and she blamed Gorbachev for the dreadful thing that he'd done to ruin, you know, the stable situation of the Soviet Union being a great power. And of course, I didn't agree with that. But I thought that we couldn't just continue having arguments. So I said to her, do you know what happened to the family that died in the purges? And she could actually tell me very little, because she'd married her husband after the war. But she brought down from a cupboard a box of photographs and papers. And in amongst these papers and photographs were a couple of albums, and clearly one of the albums belonged to Manya, and some of the photos have been showing on that reel. And I was absolutely astounded, because here are these people, this missing family that I'd never seen, and they looked like such ordinary people. I mean, the young ones were dressed in similar ways to sort of the retro fashions that were popular in the 90s in Australia. I could relate to these people. I couldn't relate to my grandmother, because she'd got married at the age of 17, and she was beautiful, but with these people there was a connection. So I was really concerned to find out what on earth had happened to them. I was so excited by the photos that I almost overlooked some little official documents that were amongst the papers. And these were sort of A5 little things with crest and stamps. And they turned out to be the certificates of rehabilitation. And issued in 1956, which I knew was just after Stalin had, after Khrushchev had revealed the crimes of Stalin, they said cryptically that the charges against each of the family members had been dropped and their sentences revoked in the absence of criminal evidence. Charges? What charges? What did all this mean? So when I went back to my friends in Moscow, they said to me that the Russian authorities were by that time starting to open up the archives and to release information about Stalin's purges. So armed with these certificates, we thought we'd try it on and go to the KGB, which was by then the FSB. So I marched up to the Lubyanka, and I'm lucky that I speak fluent Russian. Obviously not Soviet Russian, but Russian, good enough Russian for them to know that I'm from overseas and make myself understood. I really didn't expect to get very much because, after all, more than 60 years had passed since the purges. At most, I thought I would get a polite fob off from an apparatchik with a green KGB hat and, or even a direct nyet. But what I got instead was Vladimir. Casually dressed in blue jeans and a polo shirt, speaking English with a Russian-American accent, Vladimir was the blonde, blue-eyed face of the new KGB. Vladimir was so helpful that he actually dictated to me. He said, I'm sure you speak Russian. I'm sure you can write Russian. I'll dictate. You write. This is a letter from you to me, and these are the things that you should request. And while we were doing this, we were interrupted because the telephone rang, and Vladimir picked up the phone, and Vladimir winked at me and said, to the obvious woman, a woman on the phone, he said, no, madam, we don't deal in repression. We only deal in rehabilitation. And that's where the story began. From that meeting in Vladimir's office over a period of 8 years, began a journey where I went from one archive in central Russia to another archive over in Khabarovsk, and I managed to track down the secret police files of the entire missing family. And with the help of some remarkable people, I was able to put together what happened. I should point out that I was not on a quest single-mindedly pursuing family history. The reason it took 8 years was because I was working in Asia, and there were times when I completely forgot about these files. And something always came up. Chance, coincidence, meeting with unusual people, and then one link leading to another would bring me back to go, oh, if I'm going to be in Europe, maybe I should hop over and see if I can pursue some more of these files. Or on a visit to Harbin in 2000, it occurred to me that Khabarovsk is very close to Harbin, so why not take the opportunity? So all of this journey, this search, becomes part of my stories, as do the characters that I met. And they were remarkable people. There were former KGB colonels who helped me get the entire file, or as entire as possible, 200 pages I thought wasn't bad, of my great-uncle. The files that I got contained absolutely extraordinary material, because one thing that totalitarian societies do, and I think those of you who've seen the films about East Germany or read Stasiland would be aware, that totalitarian regimes keep their files because they don't know when they might have to use it to either incriminate someone else or clear themselves. So the papers were there, and there were interrogation records which contained lots of biographical material, question, answer. There were indictments, there were sentences, there were appeals written by particularly my grandmother's older brother, appealing to Soviet justice to correct this crime that had been committed because he'd been arrested. And I can still recall the emotional impact of opening the files for the first time. It was in 1996, in the town of Nizhny Novgorod, which was once known as Gorky, and you may recall that Andrei Sakharov spent the 80s in exile there. And this was the city to which Manya had gone in the 1930s, and then the rest of the family had followed her. I just want to read you the piece about sitting in that room. I'm led to the reading room with desks set up in rows, as in a schoolroom. A couple of people sit studying files. Apart from the hollow rustle of old paper and the odd whisper, there is silence. I sit down at a desk and wait for what feels like hours. In fact, the archivist returns in a few minutes. Five faded reddish-brown files lie before me, each tied with discoloured cotton tape. I stare at them. Now what? I never quite believed this moment would arrive. Opening the first file, Manya's, a chill runs down my spine. The first page is a note, neatly handwritten by the head of the Department of State Security of the Gorky Regional NKVD. Dated 7 October 1937, it says Manya is charged under Article 58.6 with espionage activities in the interest of one of the foreign intelligence agencies. She's being held in custody in Gorky Prison. Next comes an order for her search and arrest, dated 2 October, and a form giving personal particulars. Then pages and pages of handwritten interrogation records. Question, answer, question, answer. Names I have never heard jump out at me, as well as names I recognise. I feel sick. Apart from the people who cleared these files for release, no one has looked at them for 40 years. Laid out here are people's lives, their secrets. I feel like a voyeur. How different is this from reading other people's mail? I'm intruding on the lives of people I have never met. What right do I have to do this? But the injustice of what I'm uncovering is so enormous. Do I have the right to stop? The first record of interrogation starts with a pro forma biographical questionnaire. On the second page, Manya answers "Нет" 7 times. Most of the questions relate to activities during the Russian Revolution and the Civil War. Born in 1911, she was too young for that. The next page gets straight to the point. Question: when were you recruited as an agent of the Japanese Secret Service? Answer: I was never recruited into the Japanese Secret Service. Question: you are lying. Our interrogations have clearly established that while living in Hailar, you were recruited into the Japanese Secret Service and were transferred into the territory of the USSR with the objective of espionage. Do you acknowledge that? No, I do not. Your denial is useless. I insist categorically that you give honest evidence on the question. I repeat, I have never been an agent of the Japanese Secret Service. The evidence was recorded and accurately from my words and read by me. Below is Manya's signature and the signature of her interrogator. Another record is full of questions about Manya's life in Hailar. Suddenly, in the middle of a barely legible page, I see the word Shanghai. Manya tells the interrogator she went there in 1933 and worked for a while as a dentist at the women's studio before going to Vladivostok. Shanghai in the 1930s, with its tantalising mix of East and West, is a city which has long captured my imagination. No one had ever told me that Manya once lived there. Perhaps they didn't know. Leafing further into Manya's file, the page falls open at a sparsely typed page headed Extract from Decree Number 273 of 7 January 1938. This is her sentence. Heard. Material on the accused presented by the NKVD of the Gorky region pursuant to NKVD Order 0593 of 20 September 1937. Decreed. Onikul Maria Grigorievna, born 1911, Hailar, CER, Chinese Eastern Railway, to be shot. Signed. People's Commissar for Internal Affairs, Commissar General of Security, Yuzhov. Procurator USSR, Vyshinsky. On the right-hand side is a handwritten note. Shot. 14 January 1938, Gorky, and an illegible signature. I freeze. The statement is so stark and impersonal. It took just 3 words and 1 week to end Manya's short life. Now, as my time in the archives was limited, I didn't have time to read carefully. I had to go through those files and mark the ones I wanted photocopied and take notes of the ones that I wasn't allowed to photocopy. And they were usually, the ones you could read but not photocopy, were usually other people's records where they may have said something to incriminate the person whose file I was reading. So only much later, when I got back to Australia, did I start to put the picture together. And of course, the last bundle of files I got in 2000, and that was in Khabarovsk. And the truth that I discovered was chilling. At the height of Stalin's purges in 37-38, the whole family had been arrested as Japanese spies. 26-year-old Manya was held in prison in Gorky for 3 months, interrogated mercilessly, and pressured to sign a false confession. She resisted, but it didn't matter. Without a fair trial, she was sentenced to death and summarily executed. Shot through the head. So was her father. On the other side of the country, her older brother, Abram, was also arrested as a Japanese spy. But the curious thing was that at that time, he was in fact working for the Soviet counterintelligence, the NKVD, running cross-border operations across the border into China against the Japanese. In prison, he was beaten and tortured and interrogated for days and nights at a time in a vain effort to extract a confession. His file is very interesting because he understands the system he's been caught in. He writes appeals to the head of the NKVD, and in there he lists and names his torturers and he enumerates what takes place. And I had this vision of this man beaten, crawling back to his cell and writing those appeals. His appeals for justice failed. His case was heard by a military tribunal in closed judicial session without prosecution and defence and without witnesses being called. 3 years later, his health failing, he was sent to Kolyma, which is in the Arctic, where there were gold mines. There was a gulag that basically people were sent to dig for gold. And he died of starvation and cold some 3 months later at the age of 34. So only my great-grandmother Chesna and her younger son survived the gulag. And then in 1956, the entire family was cleared of any charges and rehabilitated. So I had all the information that I was looking for. I could have stopped there. But by then, I couldn't stop, because I found the whole situation so totally inconceivable. How did these people who left Manchuria to escape the Japanese occupation, who went to the promised land, the Soviet Union, then be even accused of being Japanese spies? So I was looking for logic, I guess, where there was none. But I then embarked on an exercise of trying to put this in a historical and political context, and also to try and understand the human dimension of what had happened. Putting this into a political and historical context was actually fairly straightforward, because by this time the state and party archives were being declassified and a lot of material was coming out. There were Politburo decisions, there were operational orders of the NKVD, there was even the confessions of NKVD apparatchiks who told how they had beaten confessions out of people so that they could fulfill their quotas. Because there were quotas for how many people should be arrested, how many people should be executed, down to from the highest level to the regional level to the city level to the village level, quotas were being sent out. And these provided an extraordinary insight into the machinery of Stalinism. But understanding the human dimension I found much more difficult, because why did they go to the Soviet Union in the first place? What had their lives been like? What was their motivations? There were contradictory things in the files. Some of it I knew to be untrue. There was an allegation Manya was presented with the allegation that my grandfather, Zaretsky, was a fascist. Now, I've told you about the Russian Fascist Party in Harbin. They were the enemy of the Soviets. So how could a Jew be a member of the Fascist Party? So I could pick some of the inconsistencies, but then other inconsistencies I couldn't pick. So it was a matter of putting things together, cross-referencing, looking at one's file, trying to put it all together. And I was still grappling to understand motivations and choices. So I sought out people who had known these people while they were alive, and I also visited the places where they'd lived, and that gave a sense of place. But I found that I had to suspend moral judgment because I would get very angry, and the black and white lens that we Westerners tend to use had to be put aside. One of the things that I found absolutely fascinating was the discovery that Manya had lived in Shanghai. And this took me down a completely new pathway as I searched for details of her life here. There was very little on her file apart from the information that she gave the interrogators. She said she came to Shanghai in 1933 and stayed with friends, and subsequently in another questionnaire she said it was the family of a wool merchant named Polyak. She also worked as a dentist at a place called the Women's Studio, and she left for Vladivostok in 1934. When I asked my mother what she knew about this, my mother knew nothing because she'd been a child. She'd never heard that Manya had gone to Shanghai. But two aunts did confirm that Manya and her girlfriend Rachel had gone to Shanghai, and in amongst the photos, they pointed to a photograph of the two of them together. But still no one could cast any light on the Polyak family or what this women's studio where Manya had worked was. So I assumed that it was some kind of establishment for women with a polyclinic where she might have fixed teeth. But later I found more in the files, and I'll read you another bit. Later, while looking through notes I made from pages of the Onikul NKVD files which the archive had not allowed me to photocopy, I find another snippet of information about Manya in Shanghai which leaves me totally perplexed. It is a few lines extracted from the NKVD interrogation of an opera singer in Gorky named Karmelinsky, who is described as a confessed Japanese spy. He alleges that while living in Shanghai, Manya, and I quote, had links with the white bandit newspaper Shanghaiskaya Zarya and was a member of the so-called Women's Studio, which existed on the premises of this newspaper. It was widely used for espionage purposes by various foreign consulates. I know from my own life abroad that the Shanghai Studio was an espionage organisation which the white guards used for various foreign consulates. End quote. I know that by the mid-30s, Shanghai had a Russian community of about 25,000 with their own churches, synagogues, shops, cafes, clubs and very varied political persuasions. Shanghai Dawn, or Shanghaiskaya Zarya, was the most widely read Russian emigre daily. It was owned by the same proprietor as the Zarya in Harbin and another in Tianjin. As I understand it, they were all mass appeal emigre papers which steered clear of contentious ideological debate. Still, in the context of Stalinist polemics, that might have qualified the Zarya as white bandit. I'm bemused by what sort of studio might have been attached to a newspaper. Karmelinsky's description conjures up an image of a smoke-filled journalist club where diplomats, businessmen, artists, journalists and spies gathered to drink, trade gossip and do deals, much like the press clubs I visited in Hong Kong and Washington, I imagine. But where would a dentist surgery fit? Shanghai Studio or Women's Studio? None of the Shanghai Russians I ask have heard of it. I make my first visit to Shanghai in 1998 and I meet a couple of scholars, Chinese scholars, who help me track down some of the landmarks of Manya's life here. And it turns out that Polyak, with whom Manya stayed, was a prominent member of the Shanghai Jewish community. His family lived at the Sun Court Apartments, which still stand today in Wei Highway Road. Still the women's studio, or the Shanghai studio, which clearly played a part in incriminating Manya, remains a mystery. But I get the answer a year later in San Francisco. In May 1999, the writer Rena Krasno takes me to the Hoover Institution archive at Stanford University to see a collection of books and papers which belonged to her father, the former editor of a Jewish magazine in Shanghai. Among them is an extraordinary Russian album of photographs, Russians in Shanghai, which was published in 1936 by a Russian Shanghailander, Captain Zhiganov. Leafing through it, I come across a page headed, "The Women's Professional School," and in brackets, "formerly the women's studio of the newspaper Shanghai Zaria." Below is a photograph of the building in which it was located. I'm stunned. The headline alone puts much of what I had read in Manya's file into perspective. The accompanying article explains that the women's studio was established in 1933 by the newspaper's management and in 1935 moved to larger premises and became the municipality's professional school. The studio's original purpose was to provide Russian women the opportunity to learn a trade or craft which would, quote, help them earn a crust in the long term. It offered such courses as dressmaking, millinery, manicure, hairdressing, cooking, typing, French and English. The studio must have been a real blessing for the thousands of women who fled Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution with no practical skills and little prospect of employment other than taxi dancing or prostitution. It is conceivable that such a studio might have had a small clinic where Manya may have fixed teeth. So much for the nest of spies Karmelinsky described in his alleged evidence against Manya. Through another sequence of serendipitous connections, I get to meet a woman in New York who actually knew Manya during her time in Shanghai. Elia Polyak is a charming and elegant New Yorker in her mid-80s. Over morning coffee in a lower Manhattan bistro, we unravel one connection after another. It emerges that Elia is the cousin of Rachel, the friend with whom Manya went to Shanghai. The reason the two of them stayed with Polyak is quite simple. He was Rachel's uncle, a Siberian Jew who had lived in Shanghai since 1915. I knew Manya through my cousin Rachel, Elia tells me. We used to see each other in Shanghai. She describes Manya as a brunette with big black eyes who was not very tall and wore her hair cut short. She was very pleasant, affable and attractive. I don't often remember people, but I remember her well. I show Elia a studio photograph of Manya in an elegant black dress with short hair fashionably slicked back to reveal her dark eyes and high cheekbones. Yes, says Elia, that's how she looked when I knew her. I always thought the photo had a Shanghai look about it. Though Elia doesn't know many details about Manya's time in Shanghai, hearing her talk about my relative is immensely reassuring. Here at last is a living person who knew Manya in Shanghai. It gives her life in the city a validity beyond the NKVD file. So why did I write the book? In retrospect, I think there were three main reasons. Firstly, I discovered that the fate of Manya and her family during Stalin's purges was not an individual aberration. It didn't just happen to this family. In fact, almost all Russians who had come to the Soviet Union from Harbin and other cities in China, including Shanghai, had met the same fate. Under NKVD Operational Order 593 of September 1937, all had been targeted as Japanese spies. Now, if you think back to the war years, such was the climate of xenophobia in the Soviet Union that all foreigners were regarded as potential spies, but the more so anyone who had a connection for the enemies of the Soviet state, being Germany, Poland, and Japan. So by virtue of coming from Japanese-occupied Manchuria, these people were taken. And although the order specifies Harbinsi, and I do put in the back the order, which lists, I've translated it. The order starts off saying, all Harbinsi are subject to arrest, who? And then it gives something like 19 categories, who did this or did that or did this or did that. I mean, you couldn't miss out. There's not a category that would escape. So, because, as I told you earlier, many people who came to Shanghai came from Harbin, and people who even came directly to Shanghai would have had a connection to people in Harbin. Everyone was caught in this with this order. Just as I was finishing the book, and I'd been in correspondence with a wonderful Russian human rights organization called Memorial, who very early on, even in Gorbachev's day, started to push to Memorial, the word speaks for itself, to memorialize those who were victims of the purges. And they had been digging and putting a lot of this information together. And I asked them, do you know how many people fell under this order? And the first response was, oh, we don't think it's possible to distinguish, you know, which ones fell under this order. You know, lots of people died. But just as the book was going to print, I got an email saying, yes, we've got a figure. They'd done some calculations and 48,000 people were arrested, 31,000 were executed, and the rest sent to the gulag. So this was a very little known story even in Russia, but I realised that by telling the story of my family that I had uncovered in the files, I could actually tell the tale of many. I also wanted to let the voices that I heard through the interrogation records and the appeals be given a voice, because there were extraordinary appeals there. There were voices of anguish, there were voices of patriotism and voices of defiance. But the third reason that I decided to write the book was to finish the work that had been started by my grandmother, great-grandmother Chesna. By 1956, when Stalin's crimes had been exposed and Khrushchev had started the rehabilitation process, she was in her 70s, she was an ailing woman. She had herself spent more than 15 years in prison and exile, but she doggedly petitioned the authorities to find out what had happened to her family and to clear their names. And it was due to her that I had those little certificates that allowed me to take that first step to the KGB. FSB, sorry. Same but different. Or not. But today I've focused very much on the fate of those who left to go to the Soviet Union. My book also tells the story of my family who stayed on in Harbin and Manchuria right up until 1959 and the extraordinary times they lived through. And also to give an insight into that Russian world that once flourished in North China. I returned to Harbin several times when I was doing that research. The first time with my parents, straight from M on the Bund, and several times after that. And I met some of the last Russians who were still alive in the last Russian died a couple of years ago. But I discovered strange things because they were connected to my family. So I stepped in there, as Tess said, while the window of opportunity was there, and I managed to meet them. I have a line that I say, history doesn't stand around waiting for you to find it, but if you take some action, I forget the quote, but you get my meaning, it will meet you halfway. And I was very, very fortunate to meet some of these people, but also Chinese people who have been taking various actions to preserve the remnants of these diverse communities. Harbin has a Jewish cemetery of something like 600 graves that have been identified, that have been renovated. Recently, two synagogues have been renovated, not as functioning synagogues, but the buildings have been restored. The mosque has been restored. There are Russian churches. The first one is Saint Sophia, which I think now is almost like the logo for Harbin, and that contains the rudimentary Museum of Russian Architecture. And I think slowly there is beginning to be, I wouldn't call it reconciliation, but a coming to terms with the fact that there were other people who lived in China who weren't necessarily Chinese. And last October I was very, very happy that a Chinese edition of my book was published in Beijing, because in a sense this has brought back to China my family story and the wider story of Russians in China, and in a sense is a very welcome acknowledgement that we are also part of China's history. The Chinese book has a couple of extra chapters that the English book doesn't have, and those you can find, if you want to read them in English, they're on my website, which is maramustafin.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Mara. Did your family have much to do with the wider Chinese community around them, and what insights did you, like, how self-contained was the world that you discovered?
This is too loud. My family was quite unique in the sense that my parents graduated in Oriental studies and were Chinese linguists. So they graduated in 1951, so that's after the revolution. They were the sort of intermediaries or interpreters between the East European advisors who were coming in to work with the Chinese on constructions of, my parents worked on the sugar refinery, other people worked on the railway, but that wasn't a common thing. Because my grandfather was a cattle trader and spent a lot of time in Haila and Manchuria, sort of outer Manchuria, he had acquired a smattering of Chinese. He worked with both Chinese and Mongols. But that wasn't a common experience. I mean, by and large, the communities were separate. I think the boys would go down to Chinatown to, particularly, I hear stories about when on Yom Kippur, they'd go to the synagogue in the morning and then duck down to Chinatown for lunch. Sorry if I've revealed something. But, it was fairly separate. But for us, it was, for my parents, it was very hard to leave because they'd never come from Russia, they'd never been to Russia, they didn't want to go there. And they lost their jobs in this role of intermediaries because in 1956, the Soviet consulate, which managed all Russians in Manchuria, said that we should all go and till the virgin soils because Khrushchev had started the virgin soils campaign, so all Russians were encouraged to leave to help build Siberia and Kazakhstan. My parents refused to do that, therefore they lost their jobs. My father then went to teach at the Institute of Languages because they still, learning language, teaching the Chinese Russian. That was important, so they let him work to the end, but my mother couldn't work. But it was hard for them to go, but also it was hard for them to live through the campaigns because they were there during Mao's early campaigns and the self-examination and the self-confession, and they had a couple of Chinese friends who committed suicide. They'd come to Harbin from Shanghai and they were being accused of being wealthy, etc. So yeah, they felt it very personally.
Any more questions?
Hello. With your story and the success of the research that you managed to find out, how do you think these sorts of books and the research will impact modern historiography and the rewriting of modern history?
I think that's a question for Professor Reynolds, but I think this is a I think increasingly these kind of books where it's not just dry historical facts but actually using archival material, using oral history, is giving a much greater richness to the history that we have. It's not either or. I couldn't have done this research without being able to also look at your more traditional history books that tell the other story or the official story. But I think it gives a much, much greater richness and an understanding to all of us.
Yes, I was wondering, did you have any opportunity to look at the Japanese files on, you know, obviously the Kempei Tai were working there and so on. There's another perspective on them.
Absolutely.
And there are captured microfilms, and also a small group of Japanese military officers who were Russia experts were actually escaped the purge, but were there by the American authorities to glean anything on the whole Russian thing. And that stuff is probably still available in the MacArthur Memorial Library. MacArthur Memorial Library, which is an occupation, of Japan Library. So there is material in English translated from captured microfilm files that you might like to consider.
Thank you very much for that insight. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk. Sorry, me. I was just wondering, when you returned to Harbin with your parents in 2000, what was their reaction when they saw the city of Harbin after being away so long? And did new stories and perhaps new to you come out of that visit as their memories were being jogged by things they saw?
Great question. My parents didn't want to go to Harbin. They would not have gone if it wasn't for me, because they said, we want to remember it as it was before, in our youth. But then they thought again and thought it was important to go so that they could connect for me the places and the stories that I'd heard with the actual physical place. Inevitably, they were looking for what was gone. They were looking at what was gone. So they were horrified that we arrived in Harbin on my birthday, and my father wanted, well, on the eve of my birthday. My father wanted to buy some flowers, and he went to the place where there used to be a florist. And the florist wasn't there. Dad, it's 40 years. And, you know, the thing that you always do is you go to look for your old house. Our old house had been replaced by China Commercial Bank. But they were looking for what was gone, and I was seeing what was still left, because I'd lived in Cambodia, I'd lived in Vietnam, and I was used to sort of going, ooh, ah, at a remnant of a frieze, and look at that. That's a bit of history that's left. But they were immensely reassured, because we found two of their schools, and the schools were still standing and functioning as schools. The Jewish cemetery, my mother found her grandparents' graves. And more importantly, when they walked along the Songhua River, which is a huge sort of promenade that they always used to do, they were able to stop and chat to Chinese people their age. And the Chinese would say, you know, where are you from, blah, 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 but we used to live here. And then they would start exchanging memories of the Chinese remembered when they were there. And, of course, my parents both speak fluent Mandarin. I mean, my greatest regret is that I resisted. But, well, if you go to Russian school every Saturday for 10 years, you want a break. But, yeah. But, yeah, and it did conjure things back, because as you walk along the streets, they would point out to, you know, this is where the butcher shop was. I didn't realise that, you know, apart from having a wholesale business, my grandfather's brother also had a butcher shop at the marketplace and a kosher butcher shop around the corner from the synagogue. So stories came out for the whole week we were there.
Oh my. Okay. Any other questions?
Hi, Mara. Thanks so much. That's been absolutely fascinating. I was just wondering whether You were consulted very widely for the Chinese translation of the book. It's interesting that the title had to be changed slightly. And it's great that you've let us know about the extra chapters. But I'm sure there must have been some interesting developments in the translation process.
The translation is actually an interesting story because, and that's the preface, I gave a copy to the ambassador's wife in Beijing a couple of years ago because she said, look, there's a translator who specialises in Australian literature. Give me the book and I'll give it to him and we'll see. And I said, sure, here you go, and completely forgot. And 2 years later, out of the blue, I get an email saying, I am Li Yao, I am translating your book. And for those of you who were here yesterday to listen to David Ma, Li Yao's first Australian book that he translated was Patrick White's Tree of Man. For those of you who don't know, it's a very complicated book. But it's difficult for me to know how much is there. My father has looked at it, but he doesn't like simplified Chinese because he's a traditionalist. My Australian publisher's father is Pierre Rickman, so he's got a copy and I'm hoping for him to have a look at it. But from what I heard, and I'm going to see Li Yao in Beijing tomorrow, I don't think there was much interference. It had to go through the censorship process. The change of the name I was actually happy with because Secrets and Spies was, that was Random House's title. You know how it is. Sells books. When I've been talking about, there have been articles and reviews of this written in Russian and people have spoken to me and they said, you know, in Russian, Secrets and Spies sends exactly the wrong message. So it's been translated into sort of Секреты и тайны, which is secrets and mysteries or something like that. So the Chinese edition is actually extremely clever because they've called it the Harbin Files. I was worried about how would people know that, you know, Harbin Dangan just means Harbin Archive or Harbin Files. How would people know that it's about Russians? And what they've done is they've taken a copy of Manya's interrogation record, so it's got Russian writing and Russian stamps up the top. And at one stage they said to me, well, what's another title you might have thought of before? And I said, Blood on the Snow. And they said, Red Water on White Water doesn't work. But if you look at the cover, what they've done is they've created the white and the red title is the Blood on the Snow. So I look forward to finding out what Li Yao, you know, actually the process when it was translated. But I think probably he has done so many books that I don't know if he's self-centered, but he didn't say he did.
I've just been looking at your family tree that you put in the front of your book, and you weren't able to go back that far, it looks like, on your father's side. I was just curious if you'd talk about that, if that their influence and where they are now, the rest of them.
On my father's side is the Tatar family and the Russian Orthodox family. The problem was that both my grandfather, my Muslim grandfather died in China before we left, and my grandmother didn't come with us to Australia. She went to Saratov in Russia. And she died very early in the 60s. So, and my father doesn't know much about that family because he said that, you know, the Mustafines, I mean, it was the dislocation of the Civil War. My grandmother went to Saratov because she had a niece there. But my father hasn't kept contact. I'm actually planning to go to Kazan, which is where the Tatars come from, in June when I'm in Moscow, and who knows, maybe I'll get to Saratov at the same time or some other time, but that one might be more difficult. I should say that the other archives I got into were actually in China, and I got access to the Public Security Bureau records on the Russians,
And of course, the handicap is that I don't read Chinese, but there was Russian material, there was Chinese material, so I copied the Russian material. And there was incredible stuff on the files, like my mother having to write an apology to the Public Security Bureau policeman who came to the house, and she'd been rude to him. So there was an apology there, because he discovered that one of the Chinese who was living in our house wasn't supposed to be living there. And she'd blurted out that she lived there when in fact she was registered at another address. But, I mean, one of the things I always say to my Chinese friends is that in institutions like the Heilongjiang Academy of Social Sciences and the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, how important it is to open up these archives while, A, people who are interested are still alive, and people who can actually give you some insights on it are still alive. And there's all manner of reasons why, I mean, the Jewish community archives in Harbin are still closed because I think Peng Guang or someone gave me the explanation that they're afraid that if they release these archives, people will say, but that was my property and I want it back. I think people could have done that already. There were already laws that enabled you to seek compensation for property, so I think it's an excuse. But we encourage this to happen because I think, again, it's about filling in the blank spots of history, to quote Gorbachev.
One more question.
I just have a question about pre-1949 Russia, Harbin. Were the servants, we know that most of our interactions are with our servants. Were the servants Russian servants or were they Chinese servants?
Russian.
No Chinese servants at all.
It was not because the Russians didn't want it, but it was not done.
We had a Chinese chef,
Michelle. And he was wonderful. His name was Alexander and he was gay. And he was incredibly well dressed, and on some days he'd go out for his promenade. And he taught my grandmother how to cook Russian food, actually. But my mother was walking along the river, and she saw Alexander sort of walking along looking wonderful. So she went running over to him and said, "Alexander, Alexander," and he just looked at her and he said, "Not now."
I think we are going to have to wrap up by the time we get to sort of sign books and things. So can you all please join me in thanking Mara?
Thank you all very much. You've been a wonderful audience. And thank you again, Michelle.